Good evening and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Thursday, August 8th, 2002. And the topic of this session is a forum on the Middle East. It is presented by Bishop Bob Rimbo and Jonathan Ferricks. It is number FO 2002-35. Let's listen in.
Situation in the Middle East. My name is Bob Rimbo. I'm the Bishop of the Southeast Michigan Synod and based in Detroit. And this is
Jonathan Ferricks. I work for Lutheran World Relief based in Baltimore in communication activities.
Jonathan has been to the Middle East more recently than I, but I get to start. I come at the situation from a bit of a different perspective than many, I think, because the Detroit metropolitan area has the highest concentration of Arab people of Middle Eastern descent, actually, than any place outside of the Middle East. We have about 340,000 people of Middle Eastern descent in our community. So we have a great deal of concern about the mission of the church in Southeast Michigan, but also, of course, the mission of the church in the Middle East. I visited there with a group of eight of us from the ELCA in late November, early December of last year for a five-day whirlwind tour from which I came back sick as a dog. There was some sort of cold thing going through all of us, but I'll never forget the jet lag I had after that trip. I went immediately to bed, and then Lois came home from a meeting, and I talked for about 2 hours straight about what had happened while we were there. As I said, I have concern for the church in the Middle East. I have to tell you that I went to visit there neutral. I had no idea what to expect, actually. I had never been to the Holy Land. I had had no contact with anybody there, except the opportunity came, and it was a pretty good deal, and so I took the chance. And I came back changed from that visit. While we were there over the course of those 5 days, we met with Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Palestinian leaders and people. We ate in the homes of people and sat with pastors and local congregations and struggled with them over what was happening there. We visited many of the schools. There are six schools in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan, and had wonderful experiences visiting there. This was shortly after the troubles had started again in the middle of October. One of the schools in Beit Sahur had been occupied for some time by Israelis. A tank had been driven into the courtyard of the school until the bishop got his dander up and went there and pulled some strings and yelled at people, which he tends to do when he's mad. And they finally did remove the tank from the school. While I was there, I brought tile crosses from a pottery in Detroit, and in one of the most recent battles, those crosses were destroyed at the school at Dar al-Khalina, which is just outside of Bethlehem. And it appeared at that time from reports that I heard that the Israeli soldiers were targeting Christian religious symbols. And as part of the vandalism, and that's what they were calling it, vandalism. But I think the most stunning experience I had, I guess that's the word I'd use, was at the Lutheran School of Hope in Ramallah. And if you've listened to the news, you've heard of Ramallah, because that's where Arafat's headquarters is. I think it's still there, if it hasn't been destroyed. And we visited in many different classrooms that day, and it's a grades K through, or actually it's a preschool through grade 12 institution. And we were talking with 11th graders, and we just kind of barged in on their classes and stood there and actually listened to them a lot. And I'll never forget this, because a young 11th grade student said to me, "Bishop, do I look like a terrorist?" And I thought about it, and I said, "No, you look like a neighbor. I'm from Detroit, where there are 340,000 people who look like you in my community that I serve as bishop." That was a turning point for me. The Christian church is, there are about 2% of the population of Israel is Christian. We worshiped the first Sunday we were there, the only Sunday we were there actually, in the Redeemer Church in the heart of the old city of Jerusalem. If you've been there, you know the church I'm talking about. There might have been 20 people there, because it's virtually impossible for people to come into the city of Jerusalem from outside, and I suspect that it's even worse now. Jonathan will be able to tell you more, because of the blockades. And I can tell you that when we traveled from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, which is about 7 or 8 miles, I guess, we passed through 4 checkpoints. And they put me in the front seat because I had on a purple shirt like bishops wear over there. And I had on this cross that could bring in signals from Mars. And I had an American passport. And that helped us to get through because we had Palestinian drivers. It was an amazing trip for me. And since then, I don't want to jump the gun too much here, but I guess my major concern about what is happening in the Middle East today is our national involvement and investment in it. We are paying, you may know this, we are paying more than $3 million a day to support Israeli, what I call disproportionate military force. Among the Palestinian people, and that is just unacceptable to me. What I saw there was senseless destruction of settlement camps that I call death camps, that have been in existence since some of them since 48, some since 67. Where Palestinian people live under constant surveillance. When I came back, Lois said to me, "Were you afraid?" And I have to tell you, the only time I was afraid was when I visited the resettlement at Aida, the Palestinian resettlement, and I could see surrounding us on the hills and on the buildings Israeli soldiers with machine guns. That was the only conscious time being afraid. We broke the fast of Ramadan with Muslims, and we met with rabbis, and we walked through the streets of Jerusalem, which are much more fearful now than they were then, I think. But that was the time when I felt most threatened. So I am deeply concerned about that, and I'm sure we'll have time to talk about it, but Jonathan's going to bring us up to date since November or December.
Yeah, well, in two ways. Thank you very much for that. And the first way is going to be by a clip from a video that I'm going to use in a class next week. And this video is called People and the Land. And to bring us up to date, I want to take us back 10 years, or nearly 10 years, to 97. This guy does a video here, which was on PBS in 97, very rarely, I think, to find something like this on American television. And he outlines many aspects of the theme we have here a little bit. Is it fair to call this apartheid? And I'm going to play you one section where he deals with the settlements. Because if there's one thing to think about, it's the land. And who gets to control the land? And nothing shows more dramatically what's been going on And this is 97. This is when the Oslo peace process is still alive. It's foundering, but it's still alive. It's foundering because it wasn't producing basic gains. It was dealing with superficial things. So watch this question.
Who's the director of the film?
A guy named Hayes from Columbus, Ohio. Tom Hayes. If you could hit those lights. And Lauren, if you could kick the cap off. Can we have one light back on here before I... Okay, the cap's off. You are the light. This is 97. Everything you see is much worse now. That's a typical settlement. Now it's 200,000. Tax breaks and mortgage incentives.
And the land is located. It's a program that's made by the government.
Our target is to legalize this, to build houses according to the master plan.
This part has always been attached to Zionist planning ever since the past 100 years. So that plans that were made up in the 1930s and 40s, certain areas, not out here so much, but closer to Jerusalem, and other areas were simply taken out of the files and renewed.
Percent segregated. This process is a critical thing to understand.
Well, first of all, I don't feel surrounded by Arabs. I look out the window and I see empty land. I'm not surrounded by anybody. I'm just surrounded by hills and rocks and emptiness.
First you live in trailers, and then you move into...
We're now on the top neighborhood of Shiloh, which was established in 1981, about 3.5 years after the first 8 families came here to Shiloh. We have about 50, 55 families in this neighborhood.
This is my great-great-grandfather's castle. His name is Mahmoud Beit Abdelhadi.
Palestine.
Who was the governor of Jabal Nablus during the Ottomans. This castle, the family's old house, about 200 years old, maybe a little bit more.
אני לא כל כך פוליטיק, אבל מה שאני מאוד רוצה, שזה הכל, ככה אני מרגישה, שזה הכל שלנו, ושזה גם צריך לחיות שלנו.
Thank you.
They're still building the settlements, still taking the lands, still destroying the houses, still killing. When they will take the lands and they will rent the houses, nobody can. They want us to say, thank you for demolishing my house. Thank you for killing my son. This is what they want. They don't want any sound.
עכשיו, הדבר הזה תלוי בערבים. אם הערבים יקבלו את זה, אז זה יתאפשר. אם לא יקבלו את זה, וימשיכו בדרך של המאבק, אני חושב שבסוף יצטרכו שיהיה פה רק יהודים.
If they want to be here, they can be here, and we be here also, this our land. And we not want to kill them.
זה באמת לא מיני הזכויות שלנו. זכויות הפרט, אני חושבת שמגיע להם זכויות, כמו לכל אחד, הזכויות ששייכות לעם, ששייכות לכלל, אז זה לא. זה דבר אחר.
Now it's higher than that.
In their hearts, they don't want peace. They want to get rid from us and to import Jews from all over the world to put them. What's the idea? To change the owners with people. No connection with them, with the lands.
We've got a very good suggestion. Maybe the Americans can't understand, but we should transfer their water over there. After all, Oklahoma is an oil state. You have plenty of oil there. You have to go to Oklahoma. And we are there, then they will be here.
The Israelis have the will to exist here. And the Israelis must learn how to behave themselves with this fact. That Palestinians are going to exist here and to continue existing here. Well, unless the Israelis decided to kill them all.
They are doing every endeavor to make the Palestinian people here feeling disgusting from the situation and start thinking to leave the country.
So you think that somebody who is born in South Africa has the right to remain people?
As long as a Jew. As long as you're a Jew, yes.
It's not just one person or one family, a lot of people, they left the country because they can't handle anymore the situation. And they want to leave, they don't have shelter, they are scared to walk in the street.
It's a Jewish state, it's our flag.
We felt all the time that someone is pushing us out of this country by different means, by making life miserable for us.
It's a Jewish state.
By halting our economic development. Squeezing us, taking our land.
The solution is that the Arabs should take all their brethren and divide them among the 22 countries and let them make one big Palestine or Disney World, whatever they want to call it.
Actually, what's going on is someone trying to kick out a nation from this area because he believes that it's a mistake of history that those people resided in Palestine and they shouldn't have been here from the beginning. And nowadays, we feel it. We feel that someone is trying to kick us because the only concern of him is to build a pure state for a certain kind of people.
Can we have the lights again, please? Many, many threads there to pick up on. But just let me add a few comments from visiting in April and May. Could you hit the button on the back of the top of that machine? Or put the cap back on? Yeah. I often tell people that there are the two best pieces of real estate. Let's talk about land and then about apartheid. The two best pieces of Lutheran real estate to all the Lutherans who happen to be here are, guess what? Holden Village and Augusta Victoria Hospital on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. And if you feel some attachment to this place, and if you've been to the Holy Land and you've been to Augusta Victoria on the Mount of Olives, and you feel some attachment to that, and we're just visitors, we're holidaymakers here, visitors there, if you've been there, but you can feel something. because this is such a special place in world history, in the history of the three monotheistic religions. And so to keep that in your mind, and then think about apartheid, which requires division of surface area and separation of populations. And I completely feel that the term apartheid is justified in the case of Israel and the occupied territories, just to make that clear. What happened to me in March, in April and May, when I was there for a short visit after many previous visits, was I felt like I crossed the line three times between these separate worlds that are part of apartheid. And the Palestinians speak of themselves as living now in the holes of the Swiss cheese. The cheese is the Israeli-controlled territory. The Palestinians live in the holes of the Swiss cheese. Another image is Bantustans from South Africa. Okay? And another image that hadn't crossed my mind but very poignant for us is, remember Russell Means, the Native American leader, who I hadn't heard of for 25, 30 years? He said, it's just like the reservations. As a Native American who's been and seen the Palestinian situation, he said, it's just like the reservations, what's being created. So I crossed them three times. The first time was with a convoy of aid for the city of Jenin. Remember in April when they attacked the refugee camp in Jenin? In the center of Jenin is a refugee camp. It's just like the rest of the city because the tents from 1948 are now four-story cement buildings. And who lives there? People from 58 villages that were destroyed in 1948. And they all know what village they lived in. And it's only sometimes 10 miles away in Israel proper. But they fled to this part that they hoped would stay Palestinian, and it has stayed Palestinian within the West Bank. It's right in the northern part of the West Bank, in Galilee, where it touches Galilee. And 58 villages' descendants are there, and now their great-grandchildren are of an age to protest and to say, is this our life? Is this our history? And so the Israelis, in that clampdown in April, brought Apache helicopters. They brought anti-aircraft guns on the surrounding heights that can pump 2,000 shells a minute. And they jackhammered buildings to the ground from the distance of an anti-aircraft gun. They shot them from a helicopter hovering above a refugee camp where 6,000 people lived in about a four-block area that is now, when I got there with this convoy, ground zero. And I think the term is also very apt to call that ground zero as well. What did you see? What did you feel there? An old lady, an old woman, and an old man were standing on their rubble of what had been their four-story house. And they described how during the 10-day siege, they were inside that house with 17 other people, that the kids were hungry and were crying, and that the Israeli soldiers on the roof were dropping biscuits down to the kids so that they could have something to eat, but that they couldn't leave the house because across the street, the Israeli soldiers said, were some of the resistance fighters, you could also call them terrorists if you want, who were shooting at them as they tried to take this area. In the end, the house-to-house combat didn't pay, and they called in the Apaches, and they called in the anti-aircraft guns, and they razed about four city blocks. And you're walking, when you walk there, you're walking on what happens to a four-story building that's been collapsed. And there was a peculiar smell in the air because nobody knows how many people died. The Palestinians claimed probably more than were killed. The Israelis claimed less than were killed. Some people died. We have a project, Lutheran World Relief has a project with the YMCA in the West Bank for counseling. And I talked to a counselor in Jenin, and I was struck by one thing, especially of the many things he said, but that he has never seen so many young people who think the only rational and logical step for them in their life now is suicide. And I said, suicide bombing? He said, no, just suicide. Because they're the grandchildren of the people who left, who have gone nowhere for 55 years, and who see no future as the Israeli closure has tightened on that population of 3 million Palestinians. 3 million Palestinians. So you cross into that pocket of apartheid from a remarkable place, from Galilee. Anybody been to Galilee? Have you seen the flowers? Have you seen the fields? Have you seen the hills? Have you smelled springtime? I mean, it's the promised land. It's the land of milk and honey. And in the space of a few kilometers, you go from that, the way it's farmed by the Israelis, to this refugee camp stuck in the middle of a Palestinian city, stuck in the middle of a quarantine area, closed military area. We had the pleasure of going by one of the armored bulldozers that they used to clear the area. And this is a machine that you couldn't imagine. It's the most powerful bulldozer you can imagine. I think it's made by Caterpillar. And it has an armored cabin around it. And they were able to just drive through the streets and bring down the buildings on both sides. And in fact, there were people sitting in Jenin in their living rooms where the wall had been taken away. And they're sitting there with their living room furniture with no wall facing this devastated area and sitting there as a demonstration to the world, and as the media showed up, as the aid workers showed up, that this was a place where people lived. That was the first example of crossing into an apartheid zone. Second one, never make the news. But it's amazing what you find when you do go there and follow, for example, a doctor trying to reach a village health clinic. The Muslim World Federation has 5 village health clinics on the West Bank where they try to bring health care to the people rather than having them come to Jerusalem, because you can't get into Jerusalem anymore for most Palestinians. They haven't been able to reach one of these village health clinics for months because of the closures. And the one I went to was in a town called Beit Lakia. And how we got there was we got onto a settler road. They're freeways. Your taxes have paid for them. You should go and try them sometime. They're real nice. American-style freeways cutting across the West Bank, linking the settlements to Israel proper. So you can live in any settlement and work in Israel and only have a commute of 30 minutes, 35, 40 minutes. An American-style commute works just fine because the Holy Land is so skinny. So you can even live in the Jordan Valley and work in Jerusalem if you want to. It's not a very far way to drive, and you have a nice freeway to drive on. We drove on one of these. All access roads to the West Bank, it was carved out of the West Bank, had been sealed with big, big boulders as part of this present intifada. And so we had to park the LWF, Muslim World Federation, medical van at a gas station and put a paper in the window telling the Israeli army who we were and why we were there and why we left the car there. It wasn't left to bomb them or to blow up. And then we walked down through the barrier rocks, down a bank, and there was a village taxi waiting on a Palestinian dirt road down the bottom of the hill. And we got into that, and it drove us to Beit Lakia. Beit Lakia has 15,000 people in the area. Dr. Awala from the Lutheran World Federation Hospital on the Mount of Olives was making a twice weekly call there, and I counted what happened. He was there for 4 hours. He saw 79 people. It worked out at something like 6 minutes. You think that managed healthcare, HMOs, gives you problems? Try this method of healthcare. And some people had terminal cancer, and some people had a runny nose. I mean, it was everything in between. But he treated them. He worked hard for 4 hours. There were 2 nurses helping. And then we did the reverse trip back. Now, that area was a piece of the Swiss cheese, a hole in the Swiss cheese. It had been under military curfew for 7 months. Why? I don't know. But the people could not leave. They could probably sneak out in certain ways if they really had to, at risk to themselves. But they couldn't leave for those 7 months. And this was healthcare in that pocket of Palestinians. Have you ever heard of these pockets? Have you heard of a village under blockade for 7 months? It's not in our media, you know. But this is just regular life. The last one I just mentioned before we go to questions and discussion, it was Orthodox Palm Sunday, the Sunday that I was there. And in the Lutheran Church at the Church of the Redeemer, they announced, and wonderful to have this happen in church, in a Lutheran church, they said, there's going to be a demonstration, there's going to be a march to the checkpoint at Bethlehem after church. And, you know, I used to demonstrate against the Vietnam War, and I haven't done it for a long time. And I know you're supposed to check out who you demonstrate with, because they might do something bad and you might get into trouble. So I looked around as we gathered at the place where you can start to see Bethlehem, and we started walking. And you kind of hoped you were with nice people, because up ahead was a whole bunch of barricades, a whole bunch of soldiers, and then a big truck with steel-plated guards all around it came up, and soldiers inside, and they filed out and strengthened the cordon. And here we were, a Palestinian Greek Orthodox priest, a Muslim sheikh, because they celebrate each other's holy days to a certain extent. A bunch of Catholic brothers from the Franciscans who look after the holy places. They're the custodians of the holy places. And then some Lutherans, some foreigners, some Palestinian Lutherans. And we walked up to that line. And I just mention it because on the other side was Bethlehem. It was in its 28th day of curfew. Pastor Mitri Raheb, the Lutheran pastor of the church in Bethlehem, was in his house for the 28th day with his family, going nuts. But on the phone, every couple of days I talked to him, so even-tempered, so willing not to criticize the Israelis, so hopeful about peace. And we were walking to the barrier just to let the Israelis know physically that there were people who wished they would open the city. But what struck me was, I felt pretty mad at them for what they were doing. There's a settlement that has just totally desecrated a beautiful hill that overlooks the shepherd's field. It's completely built into condos now. It used to be a wooded knoll that was the perfect postcard item to have near the place where the angel sang, you know. That's now totally settlements. It's the worst example you can think of in the Israeli belt. And I just felt the anger. There was a Franciscan priest who was really dressing down a soldier, just chewing him out, just telling him, you know, you guys are so up to, I mean, just, it was really, it's the angriest I've ever seen a monk in my life. But then we started talking to one of the soldiers, and it's kind of like, despite yourself, you manage to establish human contact with the soldiers. They're conscripts. You know, the guy we talked to was a medical student, and he spoke of how he tried to treat Palestinians like Israelis were in the wars and so on. And just that contact, I was with some people from the New England Synod, and that contact helped. It really had a strong feeling there that at that place of separation, which can make you so mad, and I'm not a Palestinian, I don't live with this stuff every day. It's three times as bad as you just saw in the film. And it's been getting worse for 55 years. You can think of all the reasons why what they feel is beyond our appreciation. And yet, that sense that we could be angry, we could make it worse, we could have pushed against the soldiers, we could have maybe got ourselves shot. But that contact diffused it. And one woman went along and put flowers in their gun barrels. And then the officer was behind and said, "Kick them up! Stand there!" You know, we wouldn't let her do that. But it sort of diffused the situation after a while, and it just really struck me that a key thought is here, that no matter what we think, on whatever side we are, it's just so clear that the violence is taking everybody in the wrong direction. But I don't want to stop with just condemning violence, because the violence comes from something. Okay, so I'll leave it with that thought. Yeah.
I think it's important. I don't know how everyone stands on the issue, but you're clearly kind of playing out the Palestinian case. And I agree. I mean, I've seen Sarajevo sieged by the Serbs, and the Bosnian Muslims there just raided for more than 7 months, and that city closed off. I mean, there is violence, and there's a point to your argument, but it's important to put it in context. I think, because in looking at your history, it's decided, I mean, I think mistakes were made scores of years ago, and the Israelis are finding themselves in a situation where context is useful. Two points to that. The first is that one thing I had done when I was in college, is I'd written a paper and I'd used the pronoun they, referring to nations or countries. And basically came back with a failing grade because the professor said it's never they, it's governments. Or in this case, I think it's leaders. Mm-hmm. And I think the relationship between Arafat, and blinking on the Israeli leaders,
Sharon,
thank you. That relationship and the animosity those two people alone have, and the fact that you were able to establish a relationship with these people across the line, I just want to be careful that we don't come across hating the Israelis, because it's really the government or an individual who I think needs to go. So that's a general comment, and it's just useful to kind of put it in perspective, because we can't take a slice of history and say, you know, yeah, those are all bad things. But you're right, you know, to parade violence, you know, it comes from someplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to be precise about the day is helpful.
Can you describe or define the term Zionism or Zionist?
Yeah.
On the political continuum, are they ultra-conservative politically, logistically, so forth? Or is there a continuum? Is there a moderate? Is there a liberal?
Absolutely.
Is there a right wing, if you will? In the nation Israel, and who's in charge now?
Yeah.
And are they the Zionists? That's kind of...
Let me make a little commercial. For the class next week, the session on the Middle East, I asked that this come to the bookstore. It's called The Link. And it's a style sheet written for American journalists so that they can get a fairly straight explanation of terms. Mm-hmm. For the whole conflict, because how you use your language and who you talk about is critical. But the main thing I'd say, that others might want to jump in here, consistently, even today, about half the Israeli public is willing to trade land for peace. And if you're willing to do that, I don't think you're a Zionist, or you're only half a Zionist, or something. You know, to call the whole Israeli public Zionist would be really not helpful. So there's a strong, latent, and extremely beleaguered, you could say, majority, or at least half, who can call a spade, and they know that you got to share the land. But then you go off into a continuum. To people like those settlers they interviewed in the movie, in the film, and that's a very, very common line of reasoning. They can stay if they want to. Never mind, we've taken their land, but they can stay if they want to. And that's sort of, it's ours. There's no doubt about that. And therefore, what they do is their problem. And I think that's a very, you know, it's a fringe, but it's a very potent fringe who behave like that.
I think there's another piece there, though, that there are also Christian Zionists.
Yeah.
And, mostly fundamentalists, they are fundamentalists, premillennialists who believe that Israel must be completely Jewish occupied before Jesus comes back for the 1,000-year reign, and there are variations in that millennialism. But that's one of the things that Bishop Yunan at Jerusalem is up against, that the what we would call mainline Christians, Catholic, Orthodox, Lutheran, Episcopalians, speak with one voice, but there are other Christians, the premillennialists, or the Zionists, who are there waiting for Jesus to come back there. And I think there's, not far from Augusta Victoria Hospital, there's a huge Mormon complex, and they're in the same camp. So there are degrees of Zionism and styles of different faith backgrounds for Zionism.
The Mormon is important because they're on Palestinian land in East Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And they bought it or got it somehow. Their behavior is just like settlers. Mm-hmm. And they fled when this Intifada got there. It's empty now.
It's empty.
They all ran home.
Well, shouldn't they leave if they want Israel to be pure? So that works.
Yeah. You fled out of fear. You fled out of fear.
We received a copy of an article maybe a month ago that was written in 1927. And it was written by, I believe, an American who had visited Palestine, and he was reporting on the first settlement in 1927. And this was a group of people from Eastern Europe who were funded by Eastern European folks, and I think also from America. And And the identical is like the article was written the day before yesterday. The same kinds of issues about living side by side or not, because they were determined. This one settlement was only the beginning. And they were debating the question of whether or not they'd be able to live side by side with the present inhabitants. And there was a continuum of opinion on that. Some vehemently no, some vehemently yes, some in the middle. It was fascinating that it was that old.
Yeah, between the Balfour Declaration in 1918, when the British government said that Jewish people had a right to a homeland in Palestine, they just declared that. And 1948, when the state was actually established, after the Holocaust, after World War II, Britain facilitated the arrival of about 500,000 Jewish people in the Holy Land. So they began settling, like you said, from into the early 20s all the way to 48.
I think they purchased land.
They bought land.
Many of them were refugees also, I think we need to say that, coming from Europe at the time. I mean, there were refugees all over Europe at that time, at the end of World War II.
No, but 500,000 came between the 20s and 48.
Oh, okay. I'm talking after 47, though. Yeah. I mean, the creation of Israel.
Right.
A lot of them were refugees settling in Europe who had no place.
Right.
I have a question. I was in South Africa a year ago, and at the time that I was watching a TV program, and they were relating their apartheid to what's happening in Palestine, and Israel. And same thing, they said, they just laid it down like that. What we were doing, and this is not happening. No. I was just wondering, how is the rest of the world relating? I know what news we're getting all the time seems to be on one side, but how about European news, and how about news in other countries? Is that similar to what we're hearing and reading also?
Anybody have experience in Europe with coverage of this?
Interestingly, we live near Canada, and I often listen to the Canadian Broadcasting Company, which is far more, in my opinion, accurate and balanced than I think the biggest culprit in the United States is CNN, to be perfectly frank. You never get, part of it is that the reports aren't very long, but they're. I just think they're slanted reports.
Yeah.
I don't know about Europe.
Europe is, I think, much more balanced, much more pro-Palestinian, you could say. Mm-hmm. Also, they have a lot more alternative opinions. And then if you go to the Middle East, it's probably as pro-Palestinian as we are pro-Israeli in the coverage. And they don't give a fair description of the Israeli side, and they have direct live television now in a station called Al Jazeera.
Could you describe the Israeli position, kind of give the best case that you can of the Israeli position, or justification for what they do?
Oh man, I think that at the level you and I encounter it, it is like the settler said, you do something which I'm sure you know is wrong in your heart, but you have rationales for it.
Yeah. What are those rationales?
Well, the Holocaust, security. But that's a cycle. The security starts to come in as a kick, Yeah.
Yeah, I may go on for a little bit, but just to answer sort of that point of view. For one thing, I think that Jews have been in Israel, not in large numbers, for centuries, centered around in the Galilee and Safed in Jerusalem and other parts where they weren't thrown out of. I think the Balfour Declaration in 1918 came about because Zionism actually started in the late 19th century, in 1880 or something. Theodor Herzl in Budapest and Austria decided that the Jews needed a homeland, and that's when they started purchasing the land. And they started moving to Israel and purchasing the land in the late 1800s, early 20th century. And they had made a case to the British that they wanted, and you have to remember Palestine, what we know of as Palestine now, was actually most of Jordan and what is now Israel. So the fact here that 90% of Palestine are Palestinians, Jordan was Palestine. That was part of the whole Palestinian mandate. That was under the Ottoman Empire. After World War I, when the Allies won, the Ottoman Empire gave up Palestine and the British took over, and that's when they started encountering all of their problems. So by 1918, they came up with the Balfour Declaration to come up with an agreement for the Jews and the Arabs who were living in the territories. And I just want to respond to a couple of these things. I mean, I just feel like if you're going to put down truth, you have to sort of give like the whole picture, because you know that 90% of Palestine, we're talking about Jordan as well, and 60% of Jordan, the population is actually Palestinian. The rest are Hashemite, and the king of Jordan is a Hashemite. Same thing with the 1.5 million Palestinians, a lot of them were in Jordan, not just in what is now Israel. I think it's a lot lower. Okay, whatever, that one is fine. And I do want to say that in terms of apartheid, I have to say that if anybody's been to Israel, you will see that the country is actually made up of Jews from many, many nationalities. A lot of the Jews came from Arab countries. They were thrown out of many Arab countries in the 1920s, 1930s. I actually lived there with my family in the 70s.
In Israel.
And my neighbors were from Yemen, India, Morocco, Tunisia. And, you know, everybody thinks it's just Northern Europeans because of the Holocaust. But actually, that's not completely true. It's a very integrated society. More recently, it's been the Ethiopians who were airlifted out because they were being persecuted in Ethiopia. So you have 60% of the Jews in Israel are actually called Sephardic, meaning they're from Arabic countries, as I mentioned, Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt, Iraq. There are no Jews in any of these countries anymore because they all had to leave, and they all ended up in Israel. So like when people think of the settlers in what is now the West Bank, they are like more like Americans or Russians who are coming in. But in terms of Israel proper, it's a very multicultural, diverse country where people are coming just from all over the place. So, and they, you know, they have to balance that out as well. So anyway, I just wanted to sort of give a different view on Israel and the apartheid situation. And also the West Bank before 1967 was actually part of Jordan. Why there were still refugee camps there from 1948, that is one thing that I think that many Israelis don't understand. After the Second World War, there were something like 20 million refugees around the world, but yet people were absorbed into the countries where they moved to. Whereas in for the Palestinians, I think what is a big crime, and that has to be mentioned as well, was what their Arab neighbors did to them. Rather than accept them into their countries in Lebanon, in Jordan, well, Jordan is the only one because they are 60% Palestinian. In Jordan, in Syria, and in Gaza was part of Egypt. These people were kept in refugee status because they didn't want the Jews to have a state. So you're dealing with people who have been in these refugee camps since 1948 because they were not allowed to be integrated into the society's surrounding. So I think that's a big issue. And in the West Bank, it was part of Jordan, and then the Israelis came in. It's a very difficult situation. I think Israelis aren't happy with this situation. I think Israelis are afraid to go out of their homes. They're in their own form of captivity. I mean, people can't take buses, they can't go to movies, they can't go out. Young people are afraid, you know, but they want to live their lives. So I think just to bring up the other side of Israel.
And another thing too is that where the Israelis came, they used techniques, fertilization and irrigation. For centuries, the Palestinians maybe hadn't done anything within an area. And when the Israelis came, they made the desert bloom. They really worked. And now, after all this improvement, then they should give up that land again, you know? So that's another, I mean, it's not a simple
It's not simple. It's very complex. Obviously, it's very complex.
You guys want responses to these things, or they control all the water. Mm-hmm. 6,000 settlers imposed upon the most dismal piece of real estate in the world, Gaza, 4 miles by 24 miles with 1,300,000 people living like hamsters. Okay? 6,000 settlers imposed upon them, taking a third of the surface area of this godforsaken sand strip, to grow oranges, to run hotels on the beach in Gaza for Israelis to have holidays in, use more water than the 1.3 million Gazans. And where are they getting the water? From the heights of the West Bank, the part that you could say still is or supposed to be Palestinian. And they're controlling the water. They're making the desert bloom. But on whose back? At what cost? I think the idea, too, that the Jews were kicked out of all the Arab countries. Let's say, what's a cause and what's an effect? Israel had been established very controversially, imposed by Western power brokers on the Middle East, on other people's land. It was an inhabited piece of land that the Jewish state was imposed upon.
Then you have to say that about every other country. What about Australia? What about America?
Yeah.
What about all of us that are here? I mean, you know, all these missionaries of all the, you know, people that came into the Northwest, what happened to our own native people? Yeah. I mean, we would have to question every single country in the world and how they became a nation.
They are a nation now, and
you know, we need to figure out how to do this peacefully without, like, you know, mudslinging back and forth. And it's,
but I'm just saying, the people were not ejected from the Arab countries before the creation. They were ejected as a result of the creation in the Arab reaction to the creation of Israel. And it's heavy duty politics.
But the way they lived before the creation of Israel was not always the best.
Yeah, and that's a very critical point.
I mean, not to be defensive or anything, but it's just, you know, the way they had to live within their own communities or ghettos in many parts of the world was not a pleasant situation. So then,
absolutely,
you're right.
Critical point.
The creation of the state of Israel.
Yeah.
I think a point to be made is most Jews who are reasonable, even with Holocaust background, which my mother is, Zionist is not a nasty term. It was turned into a nasty term. To be a feminist is not a nasty term. It is turned into a nasty term. Zionist means the love of a safe homeland for the worship of the Jewish people. Nothing wrong with that term. Now, we can argue how much geography those Jews should have. That's what we're arguing about now. We're arguing about the pain of those who fled in 48 because they were told that the Jews were going to be wiped off the face of the earth. And they fled so that it could happen. In 67, the Jews were minding their own business again when they, again, attempted to wipe them off the face of the earth.
They were attacked by three.
I mean, exactly. During Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the war.
This is highly in doubt. The start of the 67 war, highly in doubt.
But still, I mean, still, the whole thing is, let's look at Jewish history. Jewish history, even in the Bible, go back to the Jewish Bible, is never one of safety or acceptance in any country. I was raised that I am not safe as a Jew in the United States. Mm-hmm. I am not safe in any country, and history keeps repeating that. Mm-hmm. Because as a Jew, I'm either questioned, why are you doing this silly thing? Mm-hmm. The society itself has prescriptions that make it hard to be a Jew, even in the United States.
Right.
You know, such things as you're invited to a party and there's shrimp on the salad. But what's the problem with that? And why don't you worship Jesus? Et cetera, et cetera. And in school. I mean, it seems minor here, except for the bombing of the synagogue, et cetera. It seems minor. It does. But remember, there is no safe and acceptable place in the world for Jews, including Israel. No safe and accepted place for Jews anywhere. There has never been a place where Jews haven't accepted pogroms, slavery, discrimination, and if they do well, you know, then racism, huge racism. If they're, you know, Henry Ford was helped Hitler be raised. He was decorated by Hitler for the international Jewish conspiracy, American industrialist pro Hitler. So we look at all this, and we look at the lies and the racism coming out of many of the countries that claim that they want to live side by side with the Jews. I mean, the stories on Saudi Arabia and what they're teaching in the schools are unbelievable in terms of what they're saying about Jews, and the Jew behind the tree story is incredible. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that I like Sharon. I hate Sharon. I hate Arafat. You want to go? I got a list. And I think they're all associated with the devil. You know, you want to go there? I think they all are. And the people who want to keep water away from the women and children of Palestine, the women and children, I mourn for them. But women and children on both sides who are reasonable, you know, and who suffer the loss of their children. These are the ones that I cry for. But at the same time, and it's the same thing with apartheid. You remember when it ended? What did Mandela do? He guaranteed the safety of the white population. Mm-hmm. Until you guarantee the safety of the population, you have a Mandela, Palestinian Mandela, who says, I guarantee the safety, and I accept the Jewish state, and I will not put up with it. Not just words that, oh, you've been killed, oh, too bad. Well, we condemn it today, okay? We condemn it. Here's some more money to go call off another Jew. This is not acceptable. What's acceptable is human rights on both sides. Mm-hmm. But until you give the Jews a sense of safety, which historically is not there anywhere, the United States turned a boatload of Jews away and said they would sink them. Hitler sent that boat all over the place full of Jewish children. The United States Coast Guard said they would sink them if they tried to land on the United States. Yeah. And they had to ground that thing in New York. So, you know, we haven't been the best either. So we have to sit down and say, how do we give the sense of safety for both sides?
Right.
You don't ensure their safety, the Sharons and the Arafats of the world, the provinces of the world, the prince of the world, is going to have his say. Because everybody, when they get fearful, they grab on to the first leader that has the answer. And of course, the leader that has the answer usually has some violent, very simplistic, some horrible answer to give. Just that we're gravitating to Bush during the war. You know, I don't like Bush. I don't think Bush would thrive. Frankly, I don't like either sets of leaders. But I don't think he would thrive without the war. I think, you know, he'd be failing miserably now, and it's not because, you know. So I think we gravitate to the worst of us during that time, unless we get really lucky. So I think that's where we need to go. We need to go, how do we ensure you feel safe and accepted and have a place in the homeland next to somebody else who feels safe and accepted and respected in the same place?
Respond to that. It seems to me that the most insecure thing, though, that Israel is doing is the settlements. I have a cousin who's Israeli, and he tells me that American Christians should never speak out against Israel because of our history of anti-Semitism, especially Lutherans. And he thinks the settlements are a terrible policy. I think most, I assume both of you would think they're.
I think that they should have been stopped years ago.
Yeah, so I guess that's...
Sharon hadn't come to power, and they had been built up.
And the suicide bombings, the whole wave of stuff that's part of what's going on now. I mean, in Hebron, for example, you've got a tiny enclave of settlers. It's undefendable, and Israel would agree. I mean, and yet you have to lock down hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to defend those settlers. So I think the problem for me as an American Christian is I no longer can, I mean, I tried to listen to Daniel, my cousin, for a while when he told me that you just have to shut up because any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. But I no longer believe that because I think the settlements are the problem and the violence of military occupation that is necessitated by those settlements is a source of violence. And I guess I think we have to be doing something now, because the suicide bombs are only going to get worse, because there's no hope.
Yeah.
My boss, when I was working until just recently in April, right when all this really heated up, he was part of a peace delegation. He grew up and went to Israel and the West Bank. They spent 2 weeks there. He grew up in Iran. He's Iranian. And he says this goes back centuries as to who thinks that land is theirs. Each one thinks it's theirs. And talking to the people on both sides, he spent time in Israel as well as on the West Bank, he said, most of the people don't want this. You know, they can see this isn't going anywhere, and you've got the two leaders who have disliked each other intensely for years and years and years, and they are losing hope that unless new leadership comes in, there won't be an end to this. And the fear is of spreading to other countries.
I just want to say this thing about leaders, though. This has been a trend, a steady trend, what we're looking at. And it doesn't matter we have Sharon or Arafat. Barack did more settlements than Sharon has done. I mean,
Sharon was director of housing, and he was the one that built the settlements.
Yeah.
Begin, the Oslo Accord,
Minister settlements.
The division in the Israeli cabinet. You found that the Clinton administration spent a good deal of their time counting votes in the Israeli Knesset until something could be changed. Instead, what Sharon did was visit the site and aggravate the situation, knowing full well what he was doing.
But what I find helpful is don't even listen to anybody's words. Just look at actions. And the action is clearly what we're hearing a little bit here. Both sides need security. Both sides have a claim, whether we like it or not, to that land. Whether, you know, it's a fact. And there's got to be a sharing of that land. And any sharing offered to the Palestinians in the peace process to this moment, including that famous thing at Camp David, which was completely misrepresented in the American press, one more chance for the Palestinians to miss a chance. That line, you ever hear it? It just never dies. It makes them look like idiots from the word go. Nothing has ever come close to even a basic fair sharing of the land. And a guy who was in on a lot of the negotiations that I was lucky to talk to, he's the president of Bethlehem University, an Armenian Palestinian, he said that at Taba, after the Camp David, when they had one more round and they came pretty close again to something that looked like it, the Israelis were going to say it was going to be final. And Barak said, this would be all you can ever get from us. Palestinians thought, this could be a milestone for us, but it's not the end of the road. They were offered 38% of the West Bank, which is 12% of historic Palestine, talking about stuff to the west of the river. I'm not talking about Jordan. 12% of historic, they didn't take it. They weren't satisfied with 12% of what they had started with. But they were willing to take 22% of what they had started with. And if the Taba agreement had given them 22% of what they had started with, they would have taken it. But it wasn't on the table. And this is all before the blow-up of the visit to the Temple Mount and everything. And I really think it's valuable. Forget words. There are more lies in the Middle East per cubic meter of air than anywhere else in the world. Just look at actions. Just look at actions and say, does this action lead to peace? Is this action fair? Is it just? Is it taking the Jewish people away from their terrible past and what we've imposed on them? And is it taking the Palestinian people away from the past that's making them the Jews of today? They're out-Jewing the Jews as victims in the present mode of world history.
Do you think Arafat will ever have any control over the Al-Aqsa, he runs it, Hamas, the Hezbollah, all these radical elements?
No.
So who, I think that's a big issue as well. I mean, who could actually
rein in that, you know,
the situation on the ground would rein them in. It would take the wind out of their sails.
I think that the Palestinian people in general do not want this. I mean, I think that, you know, we hear about these suicide bomber mothers who are like, my son is a hero, but I think most people are just, they just want to live with their Israeli neighbors and have a life. Mm-hmm. But how do you rein in these factions? These criminals, they're criminals. I mean, they're killers. They're not suicide bombers. They're homicide bombers. They kill people. You know, so it's like, who's going to lead this? I think you're right. It has to be Mandela or somebody.
Yeah, we need a Mandela, that's for sure. Yes, sir.
I would kind of want to go back to your original point. So we're spending $3 million or contributing $3 million a day or
a day.
The U.S. is.
I want to think out hypothetically. If we were to withdraw any part of that or all of it, what would result? And I'm not sure by withdrawing it would result in anything. First and foremost, my concern would be if we withdraw any part of that money, our ally against terrorism, granted what we just said about taking winds out of sails and things like that, it would make us look, hypocritical, but I'm not quite sure that would send the right message to our own citizenry about what we will and will not put up with terrorism. I'm just curious what your thoughts are, since you raised it, if you've thought through what benefits taking money away from Israel would be.
Well, I think it would be a step toward ending some of the violence in Israel. You know, people talk about the suicide bombers and stuff, but I look at what is disproportionate military force, I think, leveling towns. I saw walking through the Palestinian settlements where bulldozers and tanks had just come through and leveled buildings willy-nilly. And that was my taxes that paid them to do that. I think that has to stop. I think that kind of blind violence just has to stop. And I don't mean.
Do you think it's a cheap insurance policy, though? We pay $2 million a day, and somehow it keeps the terrorism out from our borders.
Oh, I don't.
It's going to blow the Middle East up. It's the absolutely wrong investment.
You don't think that that's what some politicians are telling themselves? This is just an insurance policy.
They may be, but I really believe they are. They have their head in the bag themselves. And if we think we can attack Iraq without helping to solve this problem, let's get down on our knees and pray for an oil embargo. Honestly.
Let's get down on our knees and go for solar energy.
That's true.
What's up with that? You know,
that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to add something along these lines. Rabbi Robert Marks was here during the early weeks of June, and his comment was that the best thing America could do would be to withdraw the $1 billion in aid that we are giving in military aid, which he said is basically a subsidy to our own arms industry.
Ironically, Israel is so embarrassed by our aid that they have actually refused some of it now. And they are rich enough as a country that they don't really need it anymore. If we would have pulled the plug 10 years ago, it would have been important. But we've given Israel more aid than we've given to all of sub-Saharan Africa by a mile, by a factor of 10 or 20 or 30. Somebody's calculated the total value of all the loan guarantees, and it's like $280 billion. I mean, it's just an ungodly sum to a first world country surrounded by third world neighbors. It's just flabbergasting. And I think we really ought to say the war on terrorism doesn't fly for a second in the Middle East in this conflict. Because we are, by using that term and pretending that that's what's at stake here, and saying terrorism per se is the problem. Yeah. We jumped right into bed with Sharon. Mm-hmm. And anything he's done has been fine. We can even call him a man of peace. Mm-hmm. and the suicide bombing. I mean, this is really tough to say. But in all the previous Palestinian-Israeli conflicts, the kill ratio has been 20 to 1. In this intifada, it's 3 to 1.
And can you clarify that? It's been 20 to 1, 20 Palestinians have died
for every Israeli death in all of the previous conflicts, the seven wars, or however you want, 48, 56, 73, and throw in the first intifada.
Yeah, but those weren't just Palestinians, those were Egyptians and Syrians.
No, Palestinians, 20 to 1. In this intifada, it's 3 to 1. And I had not been there for 4 years. I was there in the first intifada, and the first intifada was a popular uprising. You know, the boys were in the streets throwing stones and getting shot with rubber bullets, which are real, these steel bullets with a little tiny bit of rubber, and they go right through your brain. There were 1,500 Palestinians killed, and the ratio was roughly 20 to 1. You know, 150 Israeli, I can't remember the exact thing. It was starting to change a little bit there. But in this one, after 10 years of so-called peace progress, with 9 security services on the Palestinian side, with Kalashnikovs all over Palestine, with people smuggling arms in, with all the stuff that make the Palestinian state such a joke, the one they've tried to set up on these Swiss cheese holes, there are plenty of guns around. And so this intifada is not boys throwing stones, which is not nonviolent, but it's still the moral high ground, you know? It's like, you have tanks and helicopters, I have a stone, this is my land, I'm going to fight for it. There's something to that, you know, even if you don't want to talk about violence, there's still something that has some more morality to that. This one has no morality. And the only people fighting on the Palestinian side are the bombers and the shooters. And they're young men who have the weapons. And I felt an amazing aversion to, I'm obviously biased, you know, to the side that I think has gotten the short end of the stick. But I was just stunned by the fact that this isn't a popular uprising. It's an armed struggle between extremists on both sides. Mm-hmm. You know, extremist leadership, extremist some officers. Mm-hmm. And remember, there's Israeli officers who signed sheets saying, we're not going to the West Bank. We are refusing. The number started out at, I think, 55 officers. It hasn't grown like you would hope it had. But that idea that when you take up arms, I'll go back to my point about violence at that checkpoint. When you take up arms, you marginalize how many percent of the human race? Would anybody here take up an arm and fight for something? You know, most of us, I don't think most of us would. I mean, did anybody fight in World War II? Yeah. You know, I often think I probably would have too. I had the chance in Vietnam and I got a high number and I didn't have to go, you know, but I was sure happy I didn't have to go. How many people would fight? And so the Palestinians, 1% is fighting, 0.5%, 0.25% is fighting, and an infinitesimal number is doing the suicide bombing. And the whole population suffers from that choice of violence against a foe who could just blow them away.
I mean, just
blow them away. It's hopeless. But the point you come to there is, Israel is going to have to, if they pursue this, I think it's apartheid. If they pursue this line, it's apartheid if you're not a Jew. If you're a Jew, it doesn't matter where you come from. But if you're not a Jew, it's apartheid. And if you're Palestinian living in Israel, because there are Israeli Palestinians. There's about 1 million Israeli Palestinians. And ironically, even with all the migration, you bring in the Russian Jews, bring in some Ethiopian Jews who, when you talk to them, some of them don't know they're Jews. They just want to live in a nicer place, you know. But an Israeli lawyer said to me this time, we've lost the war of the womb. The Arabs are still having, the Palestinians are still having so many babies that give them 20 years and they'll still outnumber us. Even though we've kept a lot of them out, we're not going to let them return in any peace deal. And a lot are leaving. Christians leave 3 times faster than Muslims, the Christian minority. They have relatives in Detroit. They all go and join them. They have relatives in L.A. The last Lutheran bishop is retired in L.A.
Yeah.
He should be back in Palestine holding his piece of turf, but he's not. The pressure to slow transfer, that's the key term. That's the only conclusion to the present policy of violence and exclusion and apartheid. And that's a far cry from peace. And I think there's a few years left here, not many. Jerusalem's almost cut off from the West Bank. the ring of settlements is so tight that the controls are so possible that East Jerusalem, the Palestinian capital in their minds, is just about cut off from the West Bank. So it's not very long, but the clock is on Israel's side. If we keep on the present tack of things, and so you ask yourself a lot of questions about what the violence really is, who's getting the short end of the stick, where it's taking us, and what would be another way.
I know we talked a lot today about who's right and who's wrong, and I know I guess I'm neither a Jew or a Palestinian, and I know that these issues go a lot farther than just politics, from what I'm understanding. And as you're saying, our $1.1 billion isn't much of a bargaining chip anymore. You know, whether it's there or not. And whether who's right or wrong, and I know we could go on for hours about that, as we've already gone on for about one. But what do we do? You know, as good Christians and as good Americans,
it's good human beings.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
We can talk all night about who's right and who's wrong, but...
Well, let's have some ideas for closing period here.
I have a question. Just a month or 2 months ago, one of the Saudi leaders kind of floated an idea through Hans Friedman about... maybe you talked about that before I came. You know whatever happened to that? A little flurry of interest.
Do you know what it says?
Well, basically, go back to pre-67.
67 boundaries.
Yeah.
And we'll have peace.
And
return to the refugees.
And for Saudi Arabia to say that, I think they fudged on return of the refugees.
Did they?
Yeah. But for Saudi Arabia to say that is a huge concession from the Arab side.
And also to set up diplomatic relations.
Right. It's a huge concession. I mean, I just ruined my reputation one more time here, but Israel doesn't want to do that. They don't want to go back to the 67 borders. They just don't.
You mean Israeli government?
The Israeli government.
People, right.
The people might, with the right leader.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we bring that's where the pressure needs to come from. You see, we need a solidarity between, remember, America has a lot to say here. American Jews are a major backing of the Israeli community.
Yeah.
They need us terribly. And therefore, Christians should not be doing this on our own. Okay?
Right.
Be enlisting a dialogue between American Jews, American Islamics, and American Christians on what is human rights in this area, and what is God's requirement of us? In other words, and then come from a combined effort. Instead of acting alone, let's not act as Lutherans. We know what our history is. We're going to get under fire for
yeah.
that. You bet we're going to get a ton of heat.
Yeah.
Okay? My aunt, when I became Lutheran, she let me have it. she was chased from Baltimore by Christians who called Christ the killer. You know, so that was nice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we got to have a dialogue with the American Jews and the Islamic community. I think we have to come. We have to set up something unique. And then something unique is we all agree. And then pressure the U.S. government and all the other things we are capable of doing to come to a settlement that is that honors all the traditions of the sons and daughters of Abraham.
And if I might say, that's why the right-wrong thing, I think, is important, because we got to approach it from that point of view. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but right-wrong at the discussion level, facts on the ground at the practical level as a goal for this kind of thing. But those are two good ideas, and then advocacy with more than ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We really do have to stop.
We do?
Yeah.
Kaplan is in here in 10 minutes, so.
The voice of the pastor. I'd say be informed, honestly. There are a lot of small sources of information. They're in the bookstore.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you especially to the... all of us. Left in the right time.